You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right, so here we are, living it day by day. You are a superstar, and he says what she used to always say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new edition of OWW Radio. I am your host, Alex Goff, and I am joined by one of my favorite guests, contributor of many websites, including Wrestling Observer and Sheerdog.com. Also, he blogs over at Los Angeles Times, Todd Martin. How are you doing tonight, Todd?
I'm great. How are you, Alex?
I am doing very, very well. You know, recently I began assisting my coach in teaching the kids class in jiu-jitsu. So we have kids the age of 8 years old, I believe, to be about the youngest, all the way to about 11. And you do not know joy, Todd, until you assist children in learning the art of Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Well, good.
It is quite interesting.
I'm sorry, I always prefer to teach them Muay Thai, but, you know, there are pros and cons to each.
Well, I mean, for the good ones, we teach them the Krav Maga and...
Nice fighting.
Yes. Well, listen, Todd, I mean, you don't know what that other person's going to have. And anyway, so today I brought Todd on. Tomorrow, we're recording this on a Friday for those listening. Saturday night. Or we're
that's a juice for me, by the way.
We're recording this on a Thursday. we're recording this on a Thursday. Saturday evening, we have a UFC show from the MGM Grand being headlined by Demetrius Johnson and Chris Carriasso. Talk about that fight a little bit. I mean, do you think that it's getting the respect, I guess, it deserves?
Yes. I do think it's getting the respect it deserves, which is not a lot of respect. I mean, it's a bad fight. It's a, it's a fight with a guy that doesn't deserve a title shot. A champion that hasn't exactly been lighting the world on fire. I just don't think it's a fight that people really want to see. And I mean, I think it's fine to, you know, have it as a fight. I mean, you need someone to fight for that title, but I'm always leery when you put a fight on pay-per-view that doesn't really deserve to be on pay-per-view as far as public interest goes. I think it sort of devalues pay-per-view when you do that. So yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting card overall, but I'm not going to pretend that the main event interests me, because it doesn't.
This is obviously going to be a duh statement, but my wife and I actually had tickets to this show, and we actually took the refund offer because the original main event for the show was Jon Jones and Daniel Cormier. And, I mean, you know, there's a lot of analytics. You know, Nate Silver, for example, does all these analytics at his site, 538 blog over at ESPN, and there's one statistic that's replacement over, I believe it's like average or something, where basically if you took like an average asset and then how many more points, how many more whatever wins, for example, would this person add over the average? And I mean, it seems like Jon Jones and Daniel Cormier would have been at least 800,000 buys difference between what this show may do on Saturday.
I don't know about at least, but I think it's possible that could be the difference.
Absolutely. I mean, Daniel Cormier versus Jon Jones was an exceedingly more exciting fight, and losing that fight, I don't necessarily say I'd lost interest in the show, but when you wrap up the entire Vegas experience, it wasn't quite worth going to Vegas down to see. But it's not to say that this isn't an incredibly exciting card. In the semi-main event, you have Dustin Poirier taking on Conor McGregor, and what are your thoughts going into this fight? Because a lot of people, I think the conversation that most people are having is Conor McGregor the real deal? And I definitely think that Dustin Poirier is going to test McGregor to see if he is the real deal. But what are your thoughts going into this fight?
Just one thing, by the way, I think they're going to build a Cerrone versus Alvarez fight as a co-main event, for what it's worth. But this is clearly, this and the Cerrone fight are the top two fights, I think, as far as public interest. And it's an interesting fight. I mean, Conor McGregor has talked an amazing amount of shit. And he's going to have to back it up here. I mean, Dustin Poirier is an elite 145-pound fighter. He's been in there with most of the best guys in the division, and he's beaten a lot of them, and the only guys he's lost to have been very competitive fights against very good fighters. So I don't think that Dustin Poirier by any means is going to go easily into the night. He hasn't shown a weakness as far as chin goes. He hasn't shown a weakness as far as his ground game goes. He is a very well-rounded and dangerous and young and rising fighter. I mean, it's a heck of a challenge for Conor McGregor, and we're going to see if McGregor can back up the smack talk. I mean, thus far in the UFC, he has looked very good. His performances have been quite solid. He's generated a lot of his attention for himself, but he hasn't fought anywhere near the competition level of Dustin Poirier. And it's not like Dustin Poirier is a guy on the way down. Dustin Poirier is decidedly a guy on the way up. He's younger than Conor McGregor. He trains, in my opinion, on balance with better people than Conor McGregor. He's a real challenge, and I think McGregor's a very good fighter, but he's going to have to be to get by Poirier.
Looking at a couple different websites, I believe that you're correct. The semi-main is being billed as Denil Cerrone and Eddie Alvarez, which we'll talk about next. But Conor McGregor trains at the Straight Blast Gym, international affiliate out of Ireland, and his head coach, John Cavanaugh. And there's actually a brown belt who lives here in Reno and trains at some of the local jiu-jitsu gyms, who is an affiliate of Straight Blast Gym as well. And, I mean, he is extremely excited to see his gym hit the big stage, because you have Gunnar Nelson, who's incredibly, who's making a name for himself as well, incredible talent. You have Conor McGregor, who's looking very, very good against guys who may not be, he's looked good against guys who certainly aren't the elk of Dustin Poirier. And also there's some guys on the Ireland show who are Straight Blast Gym guys as well. And do you think that Conor McGregor does well, Dustin Poirier does well, that there's a potential for maybe John Cavanaugh is stepping out as one of the more well-known coaches in the sport, in the elk of like a Greg Jackson and the like?
I mean, I suppose it's possible. I don't think they've sort of developed anywhere near the level of talent yet to where I'd say that, but they've done very well as far as establishing a bunch of fighters that can fight at a pretty good level where they didn't exist before. You know, there are a lot of guys that have come out of that gym. I mean, the last Ireland show was filled with guys that did quite well for themselves out of that gym. And granted, it wasn't like they were being matched up against a murderer's row, but they've proven to be a solid little camp. I think I'd want to see significantly more before I'm willing to sort of mark it up as an elite camp. But, I mean, to this point, they've done well for themselves.
So Conor McGregor, Dustin Poirier, incredibly exciting fight. Either way, I think if Dustin Poirier gets an exciting victory, this certainly should propel him up in his title opportunity as well in the 145-pound weight class. If Conor McGregor does get a victory over Dustin Poirier, is that the type of victory you'd like to see before Conor gets a title shot, or would you like to see him mix it up with another guy in the weight class?
I don't think you give him a title shot after this fight. I think he needs to get more wins in the UFC. He's only been around for a limited amount of time. But, I mean, I think if he beats Poirier in impressive fashion, I mean, he's one of the best 145-pounders. So I think he very much is in the mix for a fight with one of the top contenders in his next fight. And if he get by at that point, I think you very well could give him the next title shot around. I think, you know, there's sort of the Jose Aldo, who's got the fight coming up against Chad Mendez, and then right behind him you've got Frankie Edgar and Cub Swanson. I think that's sort of your elite of the division right now, but I mean, I think you could very well see McGregor being against a guy like Cub Swanson or Frankie Edgar if he's able to beat Poirier in impressive fashion.
UFC just announced they're matching up Frankie Edgar and Cub Swanson, and I love that fight. Very excited for that fight. You know, with the Ultimate Fighting Championship and other sports properties, you have to wait till they get there. But if that fight happens, man, I'm super excited for that fight. And another fight that, I mean, if only I could bring you into my mind, Todd, and just have you imagine with me how excited I am for this Donald Cerrone.
A troubled location, Alex. I don't know. I don't know if I want to go there.
Just for this one specific case, where you can imagine how excited I am for the Donald Cerrone Eddie Alvarez fight. I can't remember an Eddie Alvarez fight that I've ever seen that I've not considered anything to be but incredibly exciting and incredibly good. And Donald Cerrone, likewise. I am very excited for this fight, and I'm worried that it's almost too much, and for that reason it'll be boring. But I almost think that's impossible.
Yeah, I think it's impossible for it to be boring. I think it's possible that it would end quickly, so you didn't sort of get the sort of ebb and flow of an exciting fight that you'd expect. But I mean, as you brought up, I mean, these are two action fighters. They come to have entertaining fights, and they do pretty much every time out. I think it's I can't conceive of it not being a very entertaining fight for as long as it lasts. And it's a good test for both guys. I mean, Cowboy's been on a roll lately, but you know, it wasn't too long ago where he was sort of struggling, and there were some questions sort of about where he stood in that division. And you know, Eddie Alvarez is going to put him to the test. He's willing to stand right there with him. He also has the ground game to sort of keep things off balance. I don't know what sort of how much Cowboy's going to be able to use his reach, his jab, and his leg kicks to sort of keep range. But I think if Eddie Alvarez gets inside, he could land some big shots on Cowboy. I mean, we've seen Cowboy's chin get tested in the past. So it's an interesting fight for sure.
When Pride and UFC were the two big promotions, there was always that discussion of how the guys would do once they came over. And I think after that, I think we kind of know that, you know, the really elite guys on these smaller shows, quote-unquote, are really elite guys. You know, and Gilbert Melendez and Josh Thompson certainly answered that question for us when they made their recent UFC debuts. And the only thing I'm worried about Eddie Alvarez, and I want to know your thoughts on this, is that he had some wars, specifically with Michael Chandler, where they had some brutal fights. And do you think that there's any chance that maybe Eddie he's over his prime because of the brutal fights he had specifically against Michael Chandler?
Yes, I do not discount that possibility at all. I agree that that is a possibility. And not only against Michael Chandler, I mean, this guy's whole career, that incredible fights with Joakim Hansen and Tatsuya Kawajiri back in the dream days. I mean, he comes to fight. He's a fighter. So even against Roger Huerta, I mean, Huerta was able to tag him with a punch early on before he took over. I mean, he is a fighter that gets into wars, and those sorts of fighters do tend to once the damage builds up over time, it can catch up with guys. I certainly don't think, I think it would be silly to suggest he's a guy that's sort of, on the severe downside of his career. I mean, I think he's definitely got many years in front of him as a very good fighter. But is it possible that at 30, he's seen his the peak of his career to this point? I do think that's possible.
And I certainly, with the way the Eddie Alvarez story went, you certainly hope that's not the case, because you know the guy, he wanted to fight for the bigger companies for a while. He wanted an opportunity a few years ago to go over to Strikeforce and fight against Gilbert Melendez to really show who was the best 155-pound fighter not in the UFC. And then earlier he wanted an opportunity to go to the UFC, and he wasn't afforded that opportunity then. So, I mean, it's almost like as a personal story, I would hate for Eddie to finally achieve his dream of competing in the UFC and then not be kind of what he was prior to that.
Yeah, I mean, don't cry for Eddie Alvarez in the sense that he's made a lot of money over the course of his career, and he's had a lot of success. So, I mean, it's not like he's sort of a hard luck story. But, yeah, just from the standpoint, almost from this sort of a funny way of saying it, but from almost from a selfish standpoint, guys that I have really appreciated over the years, it sort of makes me sad when the bigger audience doesn't see how good they are, and then I sort of feel like people don't recognize just how good they were in their peak. When you see guys past their prime, and they aren't able to put it together like they did before, and you sort of, particularly in MMA, you know, there's sort of this notion amongst some fans that, Fedor was never any good, or I don't know about never any good. I don't want to I don't want to sort of create a strawman argument, but Fedor was never as good as people said he was, or, you know, even a guy like a Hector Lombard, you know, like that's sort of like he was a mirage or something, or, you know, guys like Vanderlei Silva obviously came on late in his career, or a Shogun, or a Rogério Nogueira, or Minotauro Nogueira. I mean, these guys, for all they accomplished, they may not have done as much at sort of the UFC level, but I don't think it diminishes how good they were beforehand. And Eddie Alvarez, the same thing. Eddie Alvarez is not a guy that comes into the UFC, in my opinion, needing to prove how good he is. Regardless of how he does in the UFC, this was one of the best fighters in his division of his day.
It kind of reminds me of like Juan Carlos Navarro at the gold medal game a couple years ago in the Olympics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I was I had always heard about this Spain team, and finally I had an opportunity to really check them out a couple years ago at the Olympics, and I was like, Juan Carlos Navarro, for a guy who really didn't make an impact in the NBA, is a really good basketball player. But then he's surrounded by really good talent on that Spain team as well. The next fight is Tim Kennedy against Yoel Romero, and this is a big opportunity for both guys. Tim Kennedy has really started to make a name for himself, former Strikeforce champion, and Yoel Romero has looked absolutely like a very dominant force in a lot of his fights. Is there an advantage, do you think, that Kennedy can exploit in this fight? Maybe the stand-up, because the wrestling may be an issue for him.
How much profanity can we use on this show?
None to limited.
Oh, that's a shame, because I love this effing fight. This is a tremendous fight. Yoel Romero has looked like a destroyer, and Tim Kennedy is a very good challenge for him. To answer your question, I think that the way that Kennedy wins this fight is by pressuring Yoel Romero, by getting him tired. Romero's conditioning hasn't been the best, and by dictating the pace of the fight. I think that if Romero is able to dictate the pace and go at his speed, I think Kennedy's going to be in a lot of trouble, because Romero hits really hard, and he does have that elite wrestling. But if Kennedy can keep him off balance, use a little bit of clinching, maybe take him down if Romero comes in swinging wildly and leaves himself off balance, if Kennedy's able to control the fight, wear him down, and get a decision, I think that's probably his best method. But Romero comes out hard, and he comes out looking to hurt people. This guy was an elite world-class wrestler, but he's got a fighter's mentality. He comes in there looking to hurt people. And Tim Kennedy, I mean, it's a heck of a test for Tim Kennedy. We'll see how he holds up to it.
Speaking of a heck of a test, Kat Zingano is coming back, making her return after a few knee surgeries and the unfortunate death of her husband. And there were some complications going on in her gym as well. She's coming back to a tough fight. How impressive do you need to see Zingano to win? Or do you just need to see her win before you would pencil her in to fight Ronda Rousey in January?
To me, I think you just need to see her win. I don't think there are a lot of particularly strong challengers right now in that division, because Ronda's beaten most of them. And even if she doesn't look that good against Nunez, she did look very good against Misha Tate. You can play the highlights from that. And she sort of has a nice personal story, and I think she's deserving of a title shot. So yeah, I think if she gets by in, you know, reasonably decent fashion, I think that's the fight to make next.
So last weekend, I don't know if you're aware of this, Todd, but I had the opportunity to go to a seminar by a multiple time world champion, Andre Galval, who's done mixed martial arts as well. He's no longer doing MMA. He's strictly a jiu-jitsu competitor. And he told me that he travels down to Alliance quite regularly and trains with Dominic Cruz. And the thing he said about Dominic Cruz is that he trains really hard. And he kind of attributed that to his knee problems, because he just trained so hard. And Dominic Cruz is back to fight the Takeo Mizugaki. He certainly did not take an easy guy to come back with, did not take a warm-up fight, as Takeo Mizugaki is one of the top guys in the division. What are you expecting from Dominic Cruz?
I'm not expecting anything, in the sense that I'm really not sure what we'll get. I'll be interested to see what we do get. I won't be at all surprised if he comes back looking very good, because he was an elite, really good fighter that had a very difficult style for people to deal with. And he's a proud man. He has taken a while to come back. I don't think it's likely that he would come back if he didn't feel equipped to come back. So I think there's a distinct possibility we get a good-looking Dominic Cruz. But on the flip side, I wouldn't be surprised at all as well if he isn't able to put together like he used to. I mean, he hasn't fought in competition for a long, long time. He had some very serious injuries that I think are going to affect his mobility, which was a big key to his fight, fighting style. And he's fighting a guy that's been fighting regularly. I wouldn't be surprised to see this go any which way. And I'm surprised that the odds makers have made Cruz as heavy of a favorite as they have, because the history of athletes in general coming back from serious injuries of this note isn't that good, and it's particularly not good in individual sports like this when you've got a very serious injury that keeps someone out. You know, for everyone, for every George St. Pierre that was able to come back and look at a very good level, there are a bunch of other guys, you know, like a Frank Mir that take a lot of time to get back into the swing of things after serious injuries.
I think you made a great point there, but the one thing I will say about Dominic Cruz is I think Cruz is probably trained a little bit harder for this fight than Frank Mir probably did for a lot of his early fights. Mir really hit a second win after he got his first victory. He'd come back and he was a completely different guy. It's interesting, the Frank Mir that I think a lot of people know, you know, the UFC 100 Frank Mir, he had no cardio. And his striking wasn't the best, but on the ground, he was a real wizard. And he looked like a guy who, if he put it all together early in his career, could have been something just incredible in UFC at the time before the motorcycle wreck. I mean, Frank Mir was an incredible talent.
Well, he had a great career. I mean, you can sort of, I think some people sort of diminish Frank Mir because he looked bad in a bunch of his losses, but I mean, I think he had a very solid career. I mean, he isn't one of the very best heavyweights of all time, but I mean, he's in the next group. I mean, I don't look at Frank Mir as sort of a case of what could have been. I think Mir had a very solid legacy for himself.
Well, I guess for another basketball comparison, I guess he'd be similar to, I guess, like a Chris Webber, where he looked like he could have been one of the top five. You know, he looked like he was going to be a great heavyweight, and then he ended up having a really good career, but it didn't go the path that I think I personally thought it was going to go when I first started seeing him, you know, defeat the Tank Abbotts when he won the championship from Tim Sylvia. I thought it was going to go in a completely different direction than what it did, and the motorcycle crash obviously is what took it in that different direction.
Okay, based on what you said there, I think you just had a higher estimation of where Frank Mir might be able to get. I did think highly of Mir when he came in. You know, yeah, that really unique submission to Petey Williams. He was beating some good guys, but you know, we saw from the Ian Freeman fight, you know, sort of a vulnerability in his ability to sort of take, you know, some solid punishment. And that sort of always colored my opinion of him. Whereas, you know, just, you know, for comparison point, I mean, C. Webb, to me, had all the makings of a generational talent. I mean, he, you know, I really, really, in a lot of ways, he should have been the best, you know, the best four of, you know, a 20-year span, in my opinion. So I don't think I ever viewed Mir in that light, which is perhaps why I view where he ended up going in a higher light, because I didn't have that lofty of an expectation going in.
Okay, so as we're discussing expectations, recently NXT ran another big live special on the network, and currently NXT is assembling what I've called on this show the best roster in independent wrestling with the talent they're amassing. What do you think is the potential of all of those guys having success in World Wrestling Entertainment?
Well, I mean, I think you've got to take it on a case-by-case basis. I mean, to me, the all-star of the group is Steen.
So you're saying the guy with the most potential? Or what? The term all-star, what do you mean by that?
The best guy of the group as far as an overall talent and as far as potential both. is Steen, in my opinion. I think they may not give him a chance because he's had the weight issues, and they don't like that cosmetically. So I almost sort of will be surprised if they give him the sort of push that I think he deserves. But if you give Steen the opportunity, make no mistake, Steen will get over at a main event level in the WWE. He is too good a talker, too good a wrestler, too much charisma for him to not get over at that level. He, to me, is the upper echelon of the group. From there, Sami Zayn, I think, has a distinct ability to connect with people, whether in victory and loss. He's very good at selling, generating sympathy for himself, making you care about him. It's sort of a similar trait to Daniel Bryan. I think that he's a guy that he may not get to the top, but if he doesn't get to the top, I think he will have a very solid career and be a very popular wrestler for a significant period of time because of his ability to connect with the crowd no matter what they do with him. Kenta is a guy that I think is an excellent wrestler, perhaps a guy on the downside right now, given just how good he was a few years back. He is making an effort to learn the language, but it's not going to be perfect, and they haven't booked foreign guys that well in the past. So I have some skepticism as to how well he'll get over in WWE. And then Devitt, I think Devitt has got a lot of potential there too. He showed a lot of personality towards the end of his run in the Bullet Club. I thought that he's obviously always been an excellent wrestler. I think, you know, he obviously on the smaller side as well, but if you give this guy a chance, he's another guy that I think would get over well in WWE roster, even if I don't necessarily see him in sort of that top mix. So that's sort of my evaluation of the top guys there.
What's interesting is that at NXT they're amassing this incredible roster. Definitely, I think one of the I guess it would be difficult to measure, but I mean certainly one of the best rosters they've ever had in developmental, and at the top. It seems like they have a lack of guys that I guess are ready to headline shows. We're having an issue right now where Daniel Bryan is currently out, Roman Reigns is currently out, and what do you think is the answer, I guess, to address this short-term issue? Do you believe that there is a short-term answer, or do you believe that the company needs to think long-term and address it that way?
Well, I think the short-term answer is the long-term answer. I mean, I think the way that you do better in the short term is by pushing new guys. I think that a lot of the sort of the old stopgap measures are guys that feel stale, and I don't think you're gonna do very well pushing Randy Orton in the Big Show and building things around Triple H and Stephanie. I think, you know, these are tired acts. I think you need fresh acts, and you know, that builds towards the future. So, I mean, I mentioned before with Steen, I mean, to me, I'd bring in Steen next week and I'd put him in the main event mix immediately. From there, I mean, there are a bunch of other guys that you can bring into the card and see how they take and then sort of judge it from there. I forgot Neville, too. Neville is, you know, I don't think personality-wise he necessarily has what you'd want out of the main event talent, but he's such an explosive flyer that I think, you know, he can carve out a very solid niche for himself as a, you know, a popular mid-card performer.
And the woman of the group who kind of didn't make her name on the independent scene, but she's definitely, in my opinion, a talent to watch in NXT is Charlotte. What are your opinions on Charlotte's potential moving up to the main roster?
Charlotte's done very well for herself. I mean, she's obviously shown a lot of development very quick on that I think a lot of people didn't expect, including myself, even given that she is Ric Flair's daughter, which, you know, I think speaks to how well she's done, because I think, you know, if you're going to give someone the benefit of that, you'd give Ric Flair's daughter the benefit of the doubt. The limitation with Charlotte is that the women's division has not been for a long period of time, or really ever, to be honestly, with the exception of a little run with Sable, been in a position where it really attracted large groups of fans or drew business. It's sort of been a sideshow. And the roster of women that they have is so untalented. They've got a bunch of very attractive women, but a collection of terrible wrestlers, terrible talkers, terrible performers, who are just there for their looks alone. And I think in order to make someone like Charlotte mean more, you need more people up there like AJ and Paige, and less like, you know, the gigantic cluster of women that they have after them. And I think it would take a lot of parsing, a lot of trimming, a lot of developing other people to get that division to where it would be something that you could really build around. So I think there's only so much you can do, mostly because of the condition of the overall division. But certainly, if you want to make those women mean something, you need more people like Charlotte. She's shown a tremendous amount of potential, and I think there are some talented people there in the women's division, even if they're surrounded by a sea of hacks, for lack of a better word.
Now that the Shield has been broken up for a few months, if you were to revisit that breakup, do you believe that it was pulled too early? And first of all, I ask that. Do you believe that the Shield was broken up too early?
It's an interesting question. I mean, at the time, I thought they were broken up too early, and that the story came really quickly. But, geez, where would they be right now? I mean, I almost feel like they'd have to break up the Shield by this point, because there's, you know, things have fallen apart, and there's so little other talent that, like, what would you even do if the Shield were together at this point? You know, like, would it just be, like, them against Triple H? Like, I mean, it's not a good scene for the Shield if they weren't singles acts. So while I do think that they broke them up too early in the sense of telling the story, ultimately you've got three guys now that are all, you know, that are all pretty solid singles acts, and three of the better singles acts that they have. So it's hard for me to quibble with the decision at this point.
Because I'm reviewing Raw right now. I have it on my television. And as I'm screening through the show, I mean, that's kind of the thought that came to my head, is that, A, if they were together as an act, what would they be doing at the time? And secondly, the individual acts of Dean Ambrose, seeing the embryonic stages of what Dean Ambrose can be, because I think he's really hitting on something different. Right, he's different than John Cena. He's different than a lot of other guys in his position, and so it makes him a really interesting talent. And then you have Seth Rollins, who is still developing what exactly he's going to be. And it's kind of an exciting time right now for seeing those two acts specifically on the upward build. And then you also have Roman Reigns waiting, who we don't know when we'll see him come back, but what he's going to bring to the table as well, it certainly makes it a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, I don't know where to start off from there. I mean, I think very highly of Ambrose. I think since during the period where the sort of the popularity of the business has sort of been in a slow but steady decline, essentially post-2002 or so, there have only been two real guys that I thought had the potential to really spur things in a different direction, to where if you book them the right way, I thought they had the possibility to connect with a larger fan base in a way that would bring in a large base of new fans. Number one was CM Punk, and number two is Dean Ambrose. I think Dean Ambrose is the guy that they've got right now that has the most potential of taking it off to that next level. And he may get there, he may not get there, but I am very interested to see where it goes. And I think with Ambrose, a big thing to be careful of is that part of what makes him work is that he feels more real than other people. When he cuts his promos, you sort of believe in this crazy guy. And they script so much shit. It hinders the ability of, I think, the performers to connect with the audience in a way that's believable. And I see frequently with Ambrose, he's delivering stuff that he's pretty darn good at salvaging. But to me, if you really want to turn Ambrose loose, you need to let the guy speak more in his own voice. And he's clearly such a talented performer that I think you would reap real benefits of putting him in that position to speak for himself rather than having hack writers writing for him. There's Hack again.
No,
Enter the Sandman.
Or Hack Myers, the famous ECW roster regular.
The Shaw.
The Shaw.
Yeah, that would have listed a lot of the words I keep using as well.
You know, I mean, have they lost his phone number? I mean, there's been a lot of ECW reunions, and I can't think of one that included Hack Myers, the Shaw.
I think I did see him at one. I forget which one it was, but maybe one of those Shane Douglas shows. I think I did see him at one of them.
One of those Shane Douglas shows. Did you know in 1996, Todd Martin, that Shane Douglas was my favorite performer that year?
He was really good at that point. I definitely wouldn't put him as my favorite performer, but he was a very good talker. He was a very good wrestler, and that was sort of the period where he was sort of at his most confident, and he was really clicking. I thought that, you know, that was a really good period for Shane. I mean, I think that was the most successful run of his career, was that, you know, that 96 to 99 period.
There's been, I haven't viewed it yet, but I've viewed previous WWE works on ECW. And the ECW, the one topic that I always approach on is that the fact that ECW was an alternative to what WCW was doing and WWE was doing, and then they kind of cannibalized its acts, and then Paul Heyman had to, you know, eventually numerous things happened to Paul Heyman. But one of the things that they never touch on is the fact that he had no more acts. They had kind of been all taken away, and he's kind of left with a skeleton crew of guys who were good, but not guys who were up to that level. And WWE has an opportunity here, and I think they're kind of taking it, but kind of not, to reinvent themselves with some of these newer acts on top, maybe out of, because they have no one else. But what I like about Dean Ambrose, as a guy who they feature prominently, is that when he comes out, I know he wants to fight. And
yeah.
I don't feel like you can have enough guys on your roster. And the only other guy I can think of currently on the roster is Brock Lesnar. But Lesnar built up a cachet of actual fights to where that's where he got that. And plus, he has the image. I mean, frankly, you know, I don't think that Diego Sanchez walking out would add that aura. But, you know, when Dean Ambrose walks out, I know there's going to be a fight.
I want Dean Ambrose to come out carrying a cross like that one time that Diego Sanchez did.
When Diego Sanchez gets in the cage, there's going to be a fight, Todd Martin. But walking into the ring,
he's going to be getting beat up by his opponent.
He certainly doesn't elicit. You know, the first UFC I ever went to was headlined by Diego Sanchez. It was at the Marine Corps Base Miramar, and it was a free event. And Diego Sanchez main evented against Joe Riggs, who's recently, he Plexico Burris himself. And Diego was an incredible...
That's much more tasteful than Kurt Cobain.
Well, he's still among us, Don. Let's be serious. Let's be exact. Yeah, so Joe Riggs recently Plexico Burris himself after winning a reality show from Bellator and then leaving the company. But Diego Sanchez, he was an incredible talent when he's younger. And still to this day, you know, he gets beat. He recently got beat by Miles Jury. But Diego, when he...
by everyone, okay? He hasn't legitimately won a fight since, like, 2009.
Now, weren't you one of those guys who wasn't as impressed with the Melendez-Sanchez fight?
Yeah, that was me. I mean, if you love a guy getting beaten to the ground for 15 minutes with one really good hope spot in the third round, that's a fight for you. But if you're looking for back-and-forth action, I don't know what to tell you.
You know, it's almost, I guess, the consensus among the MMA media where there's not... You know, something like that, I expected more dissenting voices because I had the same opinion as you did. Gilbert Melendez was the class of that fight, and then in the third round, Diego Sanchez was able to hit Gilbert, mostly because he was just swinging wildly. And much respect to Diego to being able to stand there with Gilbert Melendez, and Melendez is one of the top in the division. But other than that, I mean, to compare it to some of the more memorable fights that the Ultimate Fighting Championship has had, I certainly wouldn't put it anywhere in a top 50 list.
Oh yeah, I'm we're in the same boat here. We can steer this ship together. And I mean, I've been agreeing with a lot of things, by the way, that you said in sort of this little this long conversation we've had here over the last 5 minutes or so. Going back to the thing you said about ECW, I completely agree as far as your point. It's something I don't hear enough of is that ECW, while it's true that it sort of burned out towards the end and Paul was getting tired and a lot of it was sort of financial issues, a big part of that whole thing was just the fact that they didn't have the same talent they used to. You know, they had to keep replacing guys and replacing guys, and by the end game, the talent was just not the level that it once was. You had RVD, who was still one of the best guys in the business at that point. You had a collection of guys that had name value, but were sort of, long in the tooth as far as performers. And then you had some upcoming guys who weren't as good as the upcoming guys before them. That was a distinct issue for ECW. And you know, it's the same thing with ROH. People sometimes criticize the booking of ROH after a certain point. But to me, the problem with ROH was that, the best independent talent over time migrated into WWE, and the guys that replaced them, while there were some gems in there, by and large weren't as good as guys that they had to replace there, which happens over time. And then the other point, which I thought was an excellent point about Dean Ambrose being one of the guys that comes out to fight. Yeah, that's one of the things I like about him, and I think that's one of the reasons why I'm so high on him as a guy that could potentially make things better, is that, to me, a big problem with WWE these days is that there isn't that feeling that these are actually guys that want to beat each other up. And to me, pro wrestling at its best is when you are watching sort of a sport with larger-than-life personalities. And a big part of that is not, it's, hey, it's a fun show. It's, hey, I want to see this guy beat up this guy. And with all of these goofy gimmicks and the tone of the show and all the weird verbiage and all this other stuff, you really have lost a lot of that. But Dean Ambrose has that sort of base appeal of what pro wrestling is, which is one guy who wants to beat up another guy. And like you said, him and Brock Lesnar are two of the guys that are able to pull that off on the show. And unfortunately, there are only so many on that note. So yeah, that's a couple of things we were talking about before. And yeah, Diego Sanchez, not a very good fighter anymore.
A legendary show that I did in the history of OWW Radio, I brought on, I was hoping to be a contrarian to a lot of my views, which was one Benjamin Miller. And Ben Miller came on and proceeded to agree with me on everything that I said.
You know you're in trouble when you've got Ben agreeing with you.
But, that's a joke.
Ben is a good friend and a very smart guy.
To your point about Ring of Honor, I mean, I think that a lot of people may have not understood that Ring of Honor, and I've made this point throughout the years, that Ring of Honor always reminded me of WWF in 1985. It's because if you were a consumer of independent wrestling...
Hold on. Just before we start here, Ring of Honor always reminded you of WWF in 1985.
1985, exactly. Let me finish the point. So, in 1985, that was when Vince started the consumption of talent. His father had always brought in talent from across the country and booked super shows in Madison Square Garden. But Vince started to take talent from across the country that may have not been exposed on a regular basis to the New York audience. So what he had was this really interesting roster of guys from across the country, and it made for really interesting wrestling, really interesting television, and it was just a really interesting period in wrestling is when he joined all those guys together. And so Ring of Honor, when it first started, that's what it reminded me of, because if you were a consumer of independent wrestling before Ring of Honor, you may have read about some of these acts, and you may have seen them wrestle for other companies, but you had never seen them in one company consolidated like that. And that was really, to me, what made Ring of Honor special at first. I could see the guys from NWA Wildside compete against the guys from Jersey All-Pro, and the Jersey All-Pro guys could compete against the guys from APW out in Northern California. And it was this, and also the Japanese talent that they brought in. It was an interesting mix of guys, and then they started developing their own guys as well. But then, like you had mentioned, WWF started signing a lot of these guys, and after a while, what you see is it's very difficult to replace it. And also, you had the splintering of the Dragon Gate USA promotion as well, which a lot of those acts that are big in Dragon Gate USA, they would be in the mix in Ring of Honor right now as well.
Yeah, and I mean, that's sort of the appeal of PWG, too, is that they were able to bring in a bunch of those different guys.
Absolutely. PWG is much in the like of WWF in 1987. 1987, Don.
I've always thought of World Class of 1983, sort of like Mid-South of 1974, you know?
Well, you know...
New Japan of 1993, on the other hand, is more of an All-Japan of 2002.
And then AAA of 1997 reminds me of WWC from the 1986, the summer, just the summer.
Yeah, the fall. The fall was more of a UWA sort of style.
Todd, you know, I've had so many people enjoy that analogy. You're the first person to really. But that's why we have Todd Martin on to question my analogies.
I was just struck by the initial shock of the comparison. I mean, I completely understand what you're saying. Yeah.
1985. So, if you would like to read or listen to Todd Martin and his contributions all over the internet, where are a few locations people can do that?
Well, if you ask some of the people on Twitter, you can do it by watching the coverage of the U.S. Open on CBS or whatever it is. But if you're looking for a different Todd Martin, WrestlingObserver.com, LATimes.com, Shirto.com, as you mentioned before. I write for different places. You can check them out or not. It's cool.
And also, if you want to follow him on Twitter, his handle is at ToddMartinMMA. And thank you very much for joining us this evening, Todd, and thank you very much for listening. This has been OWW Radio.
All right, well, that's okay.